You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Reagan Gillum, a host on the channel, and today we're talking to Dr. Danielle Fuentes Morgan about her book, Laughing to Keep from Dying, African-American Satire in the 21st Century, published by the University of Illinois Press. I'm delighted to have a fellow Cornellian or Cornell alum on the network. And so, Dr. Morgan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great. So I shared like a little bit about your background being a Cornellian, and I was wondering if you could tell us more about yourself, your background, what sparked your interest in African American satire, and how you came to write this book.
Absolutely. So my interest in writing this book occurred long before I went to Cornell, before I even realized this was really an area of study or something that you could actually write about in academia. I can't really remember a time when satire and comedy wasn't kind of central to my life. And one of the stories I like to share about this is about my uncle Kevin, who had I had a very close relationship with him, and he died in 1997. But he was one of the first grown-ups who really listened to me and really talked to me about, you know, pop culture and things that I was interested in, and compared them to his own interests. And so even as a little kid, he and I would watch, you know, episodes of Saturday Night Live. We would go to Blockbuster and get these videos, the best of Eddie Murphy, you know, the best of Chris Rock and all of these kinds of things. And we'd watch them together. And he'd talk to me about what I found funny, what he found funny. And we'd talk about kind of the nature of comedy. He'd always fast forward, you know, the parts that he felt were inappropriate for me to watch. But we'd talk about these things together. And so from a very young age, I felt like comedy was worth conversation, that it wasn't just kind of the fact that it made us laugh, but it was worth thinking about why it was funny, because my uncle really talked to me about those kinds of things. Once I got to Cornell, I was in the very fortunate position of having a really, really great experience with the vast majority of the professors I took in Africana Studies and in the English department, particularly with African American literature. And one of my professors, Dr. Riche Richardson, told me in conversation, it must have been my first year at Cornell, to think about the thing that I enjoyed about African American literature that I would want to do 40 hours a week. Because she said, you know, when you're writing this dissertation, it's going to be a job. That's going to be your job, is writing this dissertation. And immediately, without really much, you know, preamble or too much conversation, I sort of blurted out African-American satire. And she was like, okay, well, if that feels good to you, that's what you should lean into. And so I was in the really fortunate position of having faculty members at Cornell who supported that, who didn't think, oh, this is kind of frivolous, or this is not, this isn't academic enough, this isn't scholarly enough. Dr. Margot Crawford was phenomenal in really supporting my research efforts and sort of making meaning for me out of what comedy could be and how comedy has sort of always been a part of that African-American literary trajectory, how we see it in sort of these standalone comedic pieces, but how we also see these comedic threads throughout the literature. And just this kind of way that, the professors I worked with, Dr. Degmawi Wobshet as well, these professors were really interested in my desire for this kind of interdisciplinary lens and thinking about, pop culture, thinking about literature, thinking about sort of canonical texts and merging them all together. So I was really in this fortunate position. And I don't think I realized it at the time how fortunate I was when I began this kind of work, that not everybody was encouraged in this sort of way to sort of deviate from the norms of what academic literature looks like. And I think it's been it was great because I feel like we're in this sort of scholarly boom period of talking about comedy. There are all of these up-and-coming brilliant comedy scholars, all of these African-American satire scholars who are all sort of emerging at the same time, and expanding and extending off of these brilliant satirists who were writing 20 years ago, that we're doing this kind of new thing and really able to think about these things in different ways because they set the bar for us and they set the groundwork. And now we're able to sort of reimagine and reinvent what the field looks like.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And definite shout out to Africana Studies at Cornell as well. I had a lot of great transformative classes, and I think Cornell was a great place to incubate these kinds of projects.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to begin with the title of the book and ask you about the general argument that you're making about African-American satire in the 21st century. And so your title of Laughing to Keep from Dying and your argument, it kind of casts satire as a space for Black selfhood or an expression of Black interiority. And satire is also a survival technique in that it keeps us alive. And so could you talk about this argument about the relationship between satire, Black interiority, and survival?
Absolutely. So when I started thinking about a title, I kept coming back to what Langston Hughes and others have called laughing to keep from crying, this sense in African-American cultural traditions that we often make jokes to prevent ourselves from sort of having to bear the entire burden of the sadness and the trauma of life. Within the 21st century context, I was really drawn to the fact that these comedians and satirists are still making these jokes sort of in the midst of Black Lives Matter, where we're just trying to articulate that our lives matter, something as simple as that, right? Seemingly simple as that, just to say that something matters, to say someone matters. And so I wanted to extend what Hughes and others have talked about, which is this idea that, we use comedy as an actual survival technique and that we've always used this. So for me, Laughing to Keep from Dying does three things. It creates laughter, that we are laughing about these experiences, but that the laughter highlights trauma. It highlights the reality of what we are laughing at, that even though we're laughing, there's this sort of traumatic element to it. And then it indicts the traumatizer. So it's not just sort of catharsis, but it's also serving this kind of real purpose. in saying this is the person who has caused these wrongs, who has created this harm. So the role of satire as self-making and a form of social justice for me means that it's critical to think about the real life implications of comedy in a way that's both accessible and demonstrates not just what happened in the past, but what's also happening right now. Within the frame of laughing to keep from dying, that means that we are talking really boldly and clearly and precisely about what it means to be in the 21st century, particularly in this kind of post-Obama moment where there was this sort of post-racial mythology being purported while Obama was president. And then, you know, certainly after his presidency, when Donald Trump became president, that whole idea, which, you know, is problematic in and of itself and should not have been kind of the mythology, to my mind, that people were clinging to. But once Trump was president, it really sort of crumbled and people, I don't think, were able to hold to this kind of ideology anymore. And so what does it mean in 2016 in particular and beyond to have to grapple with all of the many ways to die? There are certainly, you know, the concerns about police brutality. There are concerns about sort of racist killings and all of these kinds of things. But there are also the psychic deaths that Black people are facing every day, where you're told that you're, you know, that your way of being, your way of existing in the world is somehow inappropriate, or somebody tries to make you small or box you in. That laughing to keep from dying becomes a space for self-making where you are able to more thoroughly and more fully sort of articulate who you are for yourself, that you can use your own language, create an in-group, and demonstrate the validity of your way of understanding yourself, of yourself, your identity, the identity that you endow yourself with.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And so I wanted to begin, when you begin chapter one by talking about satire and slavery, even though you mentioned in the beginning that you didn't want to begin with slavery, yet 21st century satirists constantly refer to slavery. And I remember this made me recall this particular comedian that I don't even remember their name, but I remember the joke, which was like, why are Black people so funny? Were slaves funny? Is that where we got it from? And I thought about that in relation to your use of Jordan Anderson's letter. And so Anderson is, I assume he's a freed person writing a letter to his former master, and he uses satire and irony to make his master's request that he return to the plantation, you know, seem ridiculous. And you also mentioned that his letter was published in the newspaper, which I didn't know. So what do we know, if anything, about Anderson and his family? What does Anderson's letter tell us about satire and slavery and how African Americans use it? And, you know, what did you make of his satirical tone?
Yeah. So the Anderson letter was really one of the critical pieces of this entire book. Once I discovered this letter, it made me really realize the sort of long trajectory of African American satire. And that, I feel like that's my own sort of 21st century, late 20th, early 21st century sort of arrogance of thinking like, oh, we're doing something so different, and, you know, we're a very different kind of generation. But we see that this has happened since Africans were brought, you know, certainly this was going on, this kind of satirical insight was happening in Africa. But when we come to the New World enslaved, we see that enslaved Africans were also using this kind of language as, you know, a way to sort of articulate grievances and articulate trauma with plausible deniability, that you can sort of throw up your hands and say, oh, it's, you know, it's just a joke. Knowing nothing, of course, is ever just a joke, but you have that sort of protection and you can play into the beliefs that these slavers wanted to have about enslaved people. Oh, I'm just too, you know, I didn't mean anything by it. I'm not clever enough to have come up with something offensive. I was just talking. It doesn't matter. So when we think about Jordan Anderson, you know, census records show that he and his family existed, and this wasn't fiction. These are real people who wrote this. And I think that's really critical here, because we often hear people sort of disparagingly say, like, oh, that would never be me, or I would have fled, I would have started a rebellion, they could never enslave me, I'm too, you know, powerful, I'm too, like, self-assured. And I guess that's, you know, it's a sort of comforting mythology a lot of us hold on to imagine that, you know, the enslaved were somehow just, like, lacking some sort of revolutionary quality that you yourself have, right? Mm-hmm. But it's super disrespectful to think that. And it also, it's just not true. And what Anderson's letter does for me is to show this kind of revolutionary tone in writing, that he, what's so special to me about that letter is the fact that he's making these kinds of jokes with plausible deniability, telling his former master, you know, of course I'll come back to the plantation and work if you pay me, and if you pay me all of my back wages for the entire time I was enslaved, and you pay my wife all of her back wages. And then he sort of breaks that comedic lens and says, you know, I would rather die and starve than have what happened to some of the women on that plantation at the hands of your sons happen to my daughters. And then he moves back into that comedic lens to sort of offer himself that protection. But this is incredibly brave. And it's a way to use comedy to assert his humanity, to assert that he understands what's happened, and he is sort of, you know, he's really unflinching in articulating this. So it's the way comedy and satire can offer plausible deniability when we need it, but also create a way to sort of highlight the absurdity of real life and make it clear that the satirist understands that what has happened is absurd and ridiculous and worthy of critique.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. And that is so interesting that they exist in the census records and things like that. Every time I don't encounter this letter very often, but whenever I do, it's just learning new things about them is so interesting, because that letter is so powerful, as you talk about in the book. And so I thought that in the book you make this really interesting move by advancing this idea of this method of a satirical reading of texts that may not on their face be intentionally using satire. And so you argue that one can use a satirical reading due to the social absurdity the text underscores and the inadvertent critiques embedded within them. And this was something that I had never encountered, and I was intrigued because you use satirical readings to interpret, like, the novel Push and the film Precious, or this controversy over Obama's dad genes and an episode of Atlanta. And so basically it enables you to include within the book different texts that one might not think about being included in a book about African-American satire. And so can you talk about this method of satirical reading as an interpretation, how you develop it, and maybe an example of how you use it?
Sure. So one of the things, as I continued working on this book, that started becoming clear to me is just how blurry the line between the real and the fictional became as I was sort of watching the end of Obama's presidency and the beginning of the Trump presidency. And, you know, this started as a dissertation, but I've shifted. I had to shift a lot because, you know, my dissertation sort of ended with Obama as president. And then, you know, the book is coming out and being reworked in the midst of the Trump presidency, when all of these satirists are doing all of these new things, and the sort of way I was thinking about what satire's purpose was, the goals of African-American satire had shifted greatly under Barack Obama versus under Donald Trump. And so, you know, it's this kind of way satire and self-satire get blurry. So in this contemporary moment, I think that understanding satire as a mode to be enacted and a way of thinking about the world, that you can read the world through a satiric lens, is a way of understanding the absurdity of real life. So in some of these texts, you know, the Obama Dad Jeans one, for example, it felt to me, even though this was real life, you know, people were, there was this strange controversy that he was wearing jeans that, you know, that were a little baggy and loose fitting and, you know, that weren't as stylish as I guess the media wanted him to be at that point. That reading that as satiric gave us a way to think about the meaning, to think about the racialized and gendered meaning of how Obama's dad jeans were being sort of discussed in the media, how people were interpreting it, what the, you know, what those racial implications looked like, what the implications about Black masculinity looked like, what it means to imagine that Obama did that intentionally to sort of allay fears about his Black male body and all of these kinds of things. So it became this way to make meaning out of these situations and to not just say, oh, that doesn't matter, it's just a pair of jeans. Instead, I wanted to think about, well, what if it does really matter? You know, what if thinking about Barack Obama's dad jeans becomes a microcosm of how we're treating, how we understand the first Black president? So we make meaning, we can make meaning because we know the rules of satire in comedy and fiction. So now we can look at real life, now we can look at drama, now we can look at these other texts, both real and fictional, that seem to suggest the absurdity of real life and figure out why things are unfolding the way they are. So using satire as a lens for reading texts and as a way to critique texts is just another survival technique. It's a way to make meaning in a world that doesn't always afford us ways to make meaning, that often, you know, sort of gaslights us and tells us that we're thinking too deeply about things, the whole, you know, it's not that deep, it's not that serious. But when we use satire as a lens, we can use that absurdity, the sense of analyzing the absurd, to make meaning and to ground ourselves in the real world.
Mm-hmm. I like that satirical reading as a survival technique. That is really interesting.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And so also in the book, you have this idea of kaleidoscopic Blackness, which acknowledges all the ways in which being Black is valid. And so I thought that was a really good way to talk about complex Black images, because so many times Black audiences, we critique the stereotypes of ourselves in the media, but then we don't always have this language for the opposite of stereotypes.
Yeah.
Even like a scholarly analytic to think about that. And your term kaleidoscopic Blackness gave us this name that you know, that we can use to talk about complex Blackness. And I thought, you know, you talk about Insecure in the book, the television show, and you call it, you know, regular Black people living their lives. And I thought this was maybe a really interesting example of kaleidoscopic Blackness. But so can you talk about what you mean by this term and how you use it in the text?
Absolutely. So kaleidoscopic Blackness is kind of my shorthand way of talking about the fact, you know, and I think you said this so beautifully already, that there are lots of ways to be Black, and they're all valid, and there are lots of ways to understand your own Blackness. This is something that Black people have always known, right? Like we've always known that there are lots of ways to be Black, and that stereotypes don't hold, and that you can subscribe to the stereotype if you want, or you can push back against it, you can disregard it, all of these kinds of things, that your Blackness is your Blackness. But what kaleidoscopic Blackness really does is give us a short way of talking about it, and it pushes back against the monolithic way Blackness is often portrayed in the mainstream. One of the reasons I love Insecure so much is because it does such a really great job of showing a variety of Black women and Black men who are, you know, who understand and perform their Blackness in different ways that are all authentic to them. And what's important about that is that they are friends, and you don't have this kind of episode where somebody's Blackness is being questioned, or where, you know, somebody isn't Black enough or isn't really Black or anything. They just kind of recognize, like you do in your Black friend groups, that there are lots of ways of being Black, and that they all work together to create a Black social sphere. One of the things I love also about Insecure is that, you know, we are moving, that what Issa Rae does, and we've seen this in other TV shows as well. Living Single is one of my all-time favorite TV shows, and I think it does such a beautiful job of this, where you've got people who would normally be the, you know, the kind of one Black friend. You've got them as friends together, and they're not just friends because they're the only Black people that they know, right? It's not sort of, I'm going to be friends with you because there's only two Black people in our work group. They're friends, and they're Black, and their Blackness matters, but it's not the only reason that they're friends. And I think we see this when we see, you know, in the earlier episodes with Molly at her law firm, when we see at her original law firm, when we see Issa at We Got Y'all, when we see these women sort of navigating what it's like to be the Black friend or the Black person or the Black lawyer, the Black employee, and then retreating from that into their friend group, their Black friend circle, where they can just kind of be, where their Blackness is there, but it's not meant to sort of be the only way that you can understand them. So it's that Blackness, that kaleidoscopic Blackness allows us to think about all of these different facets and ways of being Black and how they work together.
Mm-hmm. And so satire is a notoriously tricky genre.
Yes.
And that the audience may not get the joke, or they may laugh at the wrong thing. And I think there are myriad ways in which satire can backfire. And you bring our attention to the ways that satire can maybe fail in its inability to offer a liberatory move towards social justice. And so every satire is not one where we're laughing to keep from dying. And so what satires don't produce this sense of social justice?
Well, I talk about this one specifically in the book, but I think it's one of the best examples, especially because the satirist himself has also talked about why this joke didn't work. So the Chris Rock joke from the 90s that was N-words versus Black people is kind of infamous for failing. He makes this joke where, you know, he talks about the difference between people who are the N-word and people who are Black people, and how he hates people who are the N-word, and sort of pushes them into this kind of stereotype of derogatory Blackness, where Black people are just sort of, you know, the more regular Black people living life kind of ideology. Mm-hmm. But by his own metric, he says later on that people misunderstood the joke and it did more harm than good, that it gave people a way to think about using the N-word basically, and saying, hey, Chris Rock says there's a difference. I'm not talking about all Black people. I'm talking about these Black people we disparage. So it's okay. And this is exactly the thing, that it's why satire is so tricky, because it can ultimately do more harm than good if it's misunderstood. That kind of joke told to Black people, to an all-Black audience, might still be super problematic, but there's a sense of understanding what Chris Rock's frustration is. When it's told to a multiracial audience, there is not only more chance for it to be misunderstood, but more chance for the joke to be bandied about in a way that actually discounts the satire, discounts the kind of clever point Chris Rock was trying to make, and instead just says, ha ha, there's a difference between these two people, and people who are N-words are bad and aren't worthy of our respect. The flip side is that when the joke is successful, it can be a form of restorative practice, but it's so tricky to make sure that that's actually what's going to happen, because it depends not only on the satirist's intention and making that intention clear, but also the audience has to receive it as satire. And if they don't understand it as satire and they think it's more of a straight joke, that's where the problem comes in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And I was interested also in these different modes of laughter that comedy can elicit, kind of enables this release of contradictory emotions. And you have this idea of revolutionary laughter throughout the book. And that made me also think about Bambi Haggins, who has this idea of laughing mad, which is to vent anger through the mode of laughing. But, you know, your idea is different in that it emphasizes laughter that inspires delight and sorrow in the pursuit of social justice. And so I just thought this was interesting, these like different registers of laughter that we can parse, and how maybe this laughter could also be tricky because one can laugh and not get the joke, as you just talked about, or it can be difficult to discern different forms of laughter. So could you talk about this idea then of revolutionary laughter?
Absolutely. So revolutionary laughter is the idea that that our laughter matters because it's an acknowledgement of our in-group belonging and of our Black interior self. So it's we laugh because we get the joke, because we know who the joke is about, and because we recognize that other people within our group also get the joke, that we are all laughing together. It's kind of within the context of sort of the Black cultural experiences. This is like a big inside joke, right? That everybody sort of gets it and understands what is being, why this joke is significant. And what this really means is that we know who we are, despite mainstream narratives that might try to diminish who we are, or say that we're something different, or even try to appropriate our stories. And so the laughter, when I talk about that moment that it inspires delight and sorrow, we're signaling both the humor of being misunderstood, that it's just ridiculous, right? That it's silly how often this happens, how foolish people are for not seeing our who we are, but also the horror of it as well, that this is both funny and not, and that it's that kind of in-between space. And I think even more importantly, perhaps, is the fact that it creates the space where we can connect with others who also recognize the ridiculousness of being misunderstood and being marginalized in this kind of way. That we that it opens up this Black interior space where you can be yourself for yourself and be your true authentic self, and also creates a space where you can make connections and form connections with other people who are also being marginalized in similar ways. And that's where the real work of revolution and reclaiming and restating your own identity can begin. So it's this sense of being your own individual self, but also being a part of this kind of Black collective experience that I think is really critical. And the laughter opens that up. It allows us to see, the silliness of being misunderstood. It also allows us to see the danger of being misunderstood. And it also reminds us that there are others who are being misunderstood, that we're not alone. Because a lot of what this misunderstanding does is to kind of culturally gaslight Black people into feeling like, oh, you feel so misunderstood, but, you know, we've really got your number. We really understand who you are. These are, you know, if you do this thing, you're not really Black because we've determined what Blackness looks like. If you do this other thing, it's not Black enough, or it's too Black, or, you know, all of these kinds of things. This laughter creates a space where we don't have to think about that, and we can sort of be more our authentic selves with other people who see our authentic selves as well.
Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to transition from talking about the ideas in the book to writing the book, or so I had this question about scholarly writing about satire. And so, speaking of laughter, as I was reading the book, of course, I found myself laughing out loud, you know, usually because of the funny examples, which is not very common for an academic book, but actually makes it a very enjoyable read. And of course, you communicate the importance of the ideas, but the material is obviously satirical and comedic.
Right.
And so it made me think about the difference between academic writing and the scholarly tone and comedic content. And I also, you know, deal with this myself. And I wondered if you found yourself having to balance these possibly divergent forces of scholarly writing and comedic content.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I was first interested in the material as a fan. And I always approach comedy and satire, even in my writing, as a fan and a researcher simultaneously. And so there wasn't really a way to separate the two in my writing. I think it would have felt really stilted and inauthentic to not sort of, you know, approach it with love in my heart for the material. So I write from a place of love. And I think that comes out in my material, which is why, you know, I wanted to include these excerpts. I wanted to let people see, you know, even if I'm critiquing a comedian, generally speaking, it's, you know, done from a place of love and, you know, with the hope that if they were to read some of my critiques, that they would know that I meant it in a way that's meant to, you know, inspire them to think critically about the kinds of jokes they're making and how they're disseminated. One of the things that I've been thinking a lot about as a, I guess I'm still a junior scholar at this point. I've been, you know, a professor for 5 years now. So I guess that's still junior. But that a lot of junior scholars are often told that, like, we're supposed to put aside our love for the subject because it's, you know, it reveals our bias, or it, you know, it's not appropriate in scholarship. And I kind of hate that because, you know, we came to the material, most of us at least, because we were really into it, because we liked it, because it matters to us in some kind of way. And so, you know, for me, I wanted that to come across in the book. You know, there's nothing worse to my mind than reading about comedy from somebody who doesn't seem like they get the joke or see why it's funny. Like, why are you writing about comedy if you don't think any of this is funny? You know, why would you choose this subject? And so I wanted that love to come across while also, you know, still writing really critically about the material and trying to balance that. So I'm hoping that came across in the book as well, that it's, you know, that I love the material, but that my love for the material doesn't mean that it's absolved from any critique.
No, that definitely came across.
Okay.
And you definitely have these very, you know, like you said, loving critiques where you do hold people's, you know, feet to the fire. Which is great because, you know, because you're making this point about, you know, maybe their jokes are satirical, but they're not, you know, necessarily, like you say, laughing to keep from dying, or, you know, leading us down the road of like liberation or social justice.
Right. Right.
Which was great. And so as you were talking about writing, I wanted to ask you about, and you kind of mentioned this a little bit earlier, but maybe you want to expand upon this process of turning your dissertation into a book. What was that like? And did you have to make, as you kind of said, you had to make some changes. as the time was going by. And so what was that process like? Did you have to add new material? Just can you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say only about 40% of the book, something like that, made the cut from the dissertation. And even where I'd kept the same texts or same, same things that I was researching or critiquing, my thinking had changed quite a bit from then to now. The first draft of the book, like I mentioned, was completed in 2016. Obama was still president. Dave Chappelle was kind of gone. At that point, he wasn't doing comedy. By the end of 2016, Trump was elected and Chappelle came back and was host of Saturday Night Live. So I had so much new that I had to really do. And at the end of 2016, the beginning of 2017 was kind of this return to satire and thinking about the satirical way we were trying to cope with sort of national upheavals, the kind of overt national upheavals. The chapter on Get Out and Insecure, for example, was entirely new, was completely new. And it felt really necessary to include that. And the conclusion about Dave Chappelle and his return and his, you know, being on Saturday Night Live and being on having his Netflix stand-up specials and all of these things, it felt critical to have. If I was writing about the 21st century and I was making these kinds of post-Obama moves, I felt a sense that it needed to be as up to the moment as possible. And so I was revising things up until really, you know, and adding new materials up until like the moment I was handing it over to the publisher for their, you know, critique. I think it sort of had to be that way, because the difference between 2016 and 2017 and the kinds of comedies and satires Black comedians and satirists were making is really critical. And just from a sort of fundamental level, the beautiful thing about writing a book rather than a dissertation is that you don't have to do quite so much preamble of talking about, you know, everybody that you've ever read in your life and why your, you know, argument is valid, because a book doesn't require that, whereas your dissertation committee wants to really see that you're like engaged in the literature. Fortunately, in a book, you're able to use endnotes and asides and things like that to make those kinds of points. But the book allowed me to really dig into my own analysis in a way that, you know, that's not sort of the nature of what a dissertation does. But the book, I was able to really say, this is why this is critical, and this is why we should be thinking about this in this kind of way. So the book writing process, in some regards, was very enjoyable and almost cathartic to try and think about what the future of African-American satire might look like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I really like that section where you talk about Get Out, and we've already talked a little bit about Insecure, but I know that people will really love reading that as well, because those were such, Get Out was such a, you know, critical film.
Yeah.
in Black horror and just getting at Black life, I think.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And so you mentioned that, you know, you are a professor still, I guess, a, you know, junior scholar. And so I was wondering if you use satire in your classes when you're teaching. Do you teach any classes specifically about satire? And is it as tricky to teach with satire as it is for satirists to use it on stage?
Yes. Yes to all of your questions. So I use satire in pretty much all of my classes in some regard. But particularly, you know, I teach a course on African-American comedy where as I've continued to teach this course, it's gotten more and more about satirical content and reading things satirically. And we think in that class a lot about the effectiveness of jokes and what it means if a satire misses its mark. One of the foundational texts that we use in that class is Percival Everett's Erasure, which is specifically, it came out in the in 2000, and it's this text basically where somebody, you know, without giving anything away for listeners who might want to read this book because it's fantastic. It's a book where a character sort of gets frustrated and writes this this parody of sort of abject blackness, and the parody becomes this huge success. But the satirical aspect of that is getting lost in translation. And so we think a lot in that class about what happens when satire misses its mark, what it means, you know, up to the moment when these comedians are creating, like what it means to be in this sort of African-American satirical boom period right now. And so a lot of these classes are about digging into the words themselves and thinking not only about the content, but also the context and how these work together to make meaning. And just because I'm interested in comedy and satire, I often use these sort of satirical elements in a lot of my classes. I teach a course called Cultural Studies and Literary Theory, which is a major course for the English department. And the last time I taught it, as we were going through, I think we learned like 15 different cultural or literary theories. We learned 15 different literary theories in that class. And before, at the end of each class, to sort of preview the next class, I would find a meme that had something to do with the next theory we were going to talk about, and the students would all laugh, and we'd kind of use that as our entryway into talking about how we could distill this literary theory to its basic parts. How would you talk about, you know, Marxist literary theory in just a few words if you were trying to convey it to somebody else? And so it's this way that, once again, satire can become a shorthand. And satire also gives us a way to really think about the application of literature and theory in real life as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I liked how you said the students laugh. It makes me think that using these satirical texts is also an enjoyable way for the students to learn this content. And in a way, it helps it bring it home even more to them because they're enjoying it. You know, they're getting the joke, and then, you know, they can, as you said, apply it and really learn those lessons.
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah.
That must be really, really fantastic.
Yeah, I really love teaching those classes. Absolutely.
And so so we've kept you on here for some time. And so to conclude, I was wondering what projects you're currently working on, or projects that you have maybe coming up on the horizon that you want to jump into.
Absolutely. So I've been thinking a lot about the limits of satire, especially in this kind of post-Trump moment. And I'm trying to think, how do we write about satire when the world itself seems, you know, increasingly self-satirizing, right? Like, where do we find the absurdity in fiction when real life is already so absurd? And so I've noticed a number of satirists moving from comedy to horror. And I find that really, really fascinating. Obviously, Jordan Peele is the biggest example. Even though what's interesting about Jordan Peele is the fact that he always wanted to do horror and kind of fell into comedy. And now that he's established himself so much, he's able to move back to doing these horror movies. But when we think about Us, when we think about Get Out, when we think about his work on The Twilight Zone, all of these kinds of things that he's really leaning into horror. I know Chris Rock is going to be involved in the next Saw movie, you know, all of these kinds of ways these comedians are leaning into horror. And so I've been thinking a lot about this idea of what I'm calling right now Black uncanniness, which is a way to work through the fact that the world is self-satirizing. So I see a lot of satirists right now kind of revisiting the idea of the double, or what's familiar but slightly off or slightly askew, and how it's what we know or what we think we know that's particularly horrifying. What I'm trying to do is figure out why we're going back to these ideas of the uncanny, and if it's because right now satirists are really interested in horror because they don't think we deserve laughing right now. They want to make sure that their meaning is as clear as possible. And so they are not giving us the out of laughter. I'm not sure if that's what it is, but I'm kind of, I'm really, really interested in what that looks like right now.
Wow. That sounds really great and incredibly timely.
Yeah. Thank you.
So, thank you so much. I've been speaking with, Dr. Danielle Morgan about her book, Laughing to Keep from Dying, African-American Satire in the 21st Century, published by the University of Illinois Press. Thank you so much, Danielle, for writing this book and for sharing it with us on the podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me today. This was great.